Welcome to another podcast from InsideCarolina.com, the independent voice of UNC Sports, brought to you by JohnnyT-Shirt.com, the go-to provider for all your Tar Heel gear.
I'm your host, Tommy Ashley. I'm joined by Greg Barnes and Sherelle McMillan. You're listening to the Inside Carolina podcast, sponsored by JohnnyT-Shirt.com. I've got Greg and Sherelle on because we're going to talk basketball, and Sherelle put it out there on Twitter earlier today. This is our second sort of off-season podcast on basketball, and we've tried to do them with Sherelle and Greg, or Sherelle and Rob, over the last few years, do three or four or so in the off-season, and sort of hit on things that people are talking about. And Sherelle, I'll come to you first, because the big thing this time of year is the recruiting aspect of it. And for those of you that aren't premium subscribers to Inside Carolina, you need to be one so you can read Sherelle's work and Inside Carolina staff's work on the weekly scoops and get more in depth on the recruiting side of things. But Sherelle, lately, Roy Williams seems to be casting that wider net than maybe he's used to. Maybe definitely those that follow Carolina recruiting are used to seeing. Just get your take on that. In sort of a general sense, I mean, is that something I'm imagining, or is that something that's happening?
Yeah, I think that's fair. In the past, I think what they've done is the number of offers isn't really that different, but maybe the timing of those offers is different. And I think, and like you said, it's in the weekly scoop, so check it out if you get a chance. I think what's happened in a couple of the previous classes has made them, I wouldn't say change, but just tweak is the word we use, just tweak their approach a little bit as far as offers. So this past Monday, they gave out three more. And what's unique about it is that, you know, Roy doesn't really do June offers that much. If you look back kind of when he likes to give offers is after the July recruiting period. Well, this year, the July recruiting period is only one. There's one AAU weekend or one AAU week, and then there's the other regional camps and USA basketball stuff. What replaced that was two weekends in June, last weekend and this upcoming weekend, where coaches could watch players on their high school teams, essentially. And that's what he took advantage of. And he saw Hunter Dickinson and Earl Timberlake, who play for DeMatha up in Maryland. And then he also saw Dawson Garcia, who plays up in Minnesota. And all three of those guys picked up offers Monday night. So part of it is that there's a new opportunity to see players, but a part of it also is that he doesn't have as much opportunity in July or April as he used to watch guys.
Tommy, I think part of the issue too, and Roy kind of blasted the process last week when he talked to us, but with the new recruiting rules in place, it's probably hurt lesser programs for sure. But it also kind of puts them in a situation where they're having to scramble to see some of these guys because there's such, as Sherelle laid out, such small numbers of opportunities. And so what they're having to do is you see one kid somewhere, hop on a plane, go see another two kids. He was actually talking about how they've really had to kind of adjust how they did that. And so that more than anything has probably affected their approach, although, you know, as Sherelle says, there's more to it. But I would be curious in hearing Sherelle's take on if he sees the recruiting rule change and how they've set up these basically camps is kind of how I view them. You know, a couple in June, the one in July. Is that a benefit to North Carolina? And do you think that's a benefit to Division I basketball as a whole?
I wouldn't say it's a benefit to North Carolina just because they have the resources where they can pretty much do whatever they want, go wherever they want, whenever they want. They don't have an unlimited budget, but they have a higher budget than most schools, let's put it that way. So for them, flying to Minnesota isn't really a big deal, or flying to DC and then flying back to North Carolina and then flying to Minnesota isn't a big deal. But when you get to your, you know, mid-major teams, even some of your teams in major conferences that maybe have been struggling a bit or don't have the infrastructure or fan base, you know, they just can't do that the same way. So I would say for North Carolina, it's just kind of business as usual. Things are just slightly different. But overall, I don't think it's great for Division I basketball. One of the positives, though, was that at the MBPA camp in Charlottesville, which we go to every year, there was a 24-hour window for coaches to watch guys. And that's unique because I don't know if everybody knows, but it's broken up into sneaker companies. So basically there's an Adidas circuit, there's a Nike circuit, there's an Under Armour circuit, and then there are teams who aren't sponsored by any shoe companies. And they all play different schedules. They don't play each other. But at a camp like MEPA, minus the people who went out and played for USA Basketball, you had everybody from Under Armour and Adidas and Nike playing together. So it was a good evaluation opportunity for UNC. And the three guys who got offered, two of them were there and North Carolina watched a lot, Timberlake and Garcia. So I think that's a positive. But overall, I think it's a net negative for college basketball in general.
Let me ask you, Sherelle, from sort of the high school guys or the recruit standpoint, how have the rules affected them, either positively or negatively? I would think if you close the window for viewing, it makes those viewing periods a lot more pressure packed for the players themselves. I mean, have you seen that, or is that, or are they just, you know, they're doing their thing regardless of who might be in the stands, even though I personally think that would be tough to do for a 16, 17 year old kid.
Yeah. I think it's for the top guys, you know, you're, let's just say top 100. I don't think it's that big of a deal. Like, the coaches know kind of who's good, and the coaches know who's the type of player that can play at the school. I think who it hurts is the kid who's ranked 200, who maybe hasn't been seen, but is better than 200. You know, someone like Cam Johnson, for example, say that he was, you know, I think he was ranked 227 or something ridiculous coming out of high school. You know, he wouldn't have had a chance to really be seen by high major schools if the setup was then the way it is now. So I think it hurts those guys who want to fight their way into the top 100. And we see it every year where there's somebody who just kind of comes out of nowhere and becomes, you know, a top 15, top 20 player. I remember a few years back, I guess I'm dating myself, it's more than a few years, it was Mitch McGarry. Nobody had heard of him. You know, he was okay. And then all of a sudden, he had a great MBPA camp. He had a really good couple weeks in July, and he vaulted into the top 10. Deion Thompson was someone who Roy Williams hadn't really heard of, and he saw him at some random camp in, I think, California. And he's another guy who kind of skyrocketed up from not really being ranked to, you know, top 40 or 50 player. So those are the ones who I think it hurts. For your known quantities, it's not that big of a deal, I don't think.
Let me ask you, while we're still on the recruiting side of things, and it sort of will segue us into discussion of the current team, is how has Kobe and Nas's one-and-done deal and Roy having to get the grad transfers, I mean, how much pressure has that put on the staff to get guys committed, to get freshmen committed? Or do you think they are, you know, I don't want to say married to the idea or whatever, of getting stopgap players? And now, you know, some of the one-and-dones are stopgaps, but like a stopgap player, I mean, by grad transfer, I mean, how is that affecting the approach?
Well, I think Greg was at the press conference last week where Roy Williams said he kind of preferred to have four or five freshmen in reference to a question about grad transfers. Is that accurate, Greg?
Yep, that's, he said in an ideal world, he would have the four to five freshmen instead of grad transfers, but given that it's not an ideal world, they will make use of them as best they can.
Yeah. So, you know, I think Cam Johnson has made it easier for UNC, and even Justin Knox back in the day to a degree. He wasn't the player that Cam Johnson was, but he came in, wasn't a problem, did his job, was a pretty solid backup. Excuse me. So I think he's had two really good experiences with grad transfers, and it's a way to supplement the roster because there were some players they missed on, frankly, in the class of 2019, and they had to make up for it. And they did the best job they could, all things considered, with those four commits over, I guess it was a 3-week span between March and, you know, early May. So, you know, I really think that it is a change in how they're thinking. Brad Frederick, an assistant for Coach Williams, has been really instrumental in working with some of that stuff. And I think, you know, Cam Johnson, people saw how well he played. So that was appealing to Justin Pierce and to Christian Keeling. And then I think Cole Anthony, you know, we've talked to Greg Anthony, we've written a good amount about him. I think that what Kobe White did definitely showed that Roy Williams isn't afraid to give the ball to a freshman point guard. And that's a big deal for a lot of players. So it's been, I think, a positive for UNC. And I think you'll start to see some of the rewards from that in the class of 2020.
I think it's an interesting kind of development. And as Sherrill said, I think Justin Knox is critical to all this, because we know that Roy Williams can be stubborn with how he does things. And if Justin Knox comes in, and that's not a great situation, because Roy has really talked very positively about Justin. If that wasn't a great experience, then maybe he doesn't go to bat for Cam Johnson. Because remember, you had all that stuff with Pitt not wanting him to transfer and those kind of things. But because of what happened with Knox, and obviously because of what happened with Cam, I think the coaching staff had a very good experience. And you know what? This can work. We can make use of this, even though we're not used to transfers leaving. We're not used to transfers coming in, but we can take advantage. And they have done that, and we'll have to see exactly how Pierce and Killing do. I think what you have to be careful about, and we've talked about this before, and I always use Duke as an example because they've become the one and done, the one and done representative. Them and Kentucky. But it seems like for such a long period of time, when Duke was so good, 10, 15 years ago, they always had Sheldon Williams, J.J. Redick, although J.J. was a special player, Kyle Singler, Quinn Cook with that 15 title team. Guys that were very experienced, who'd played a ton of minutes over the years. But I think one thing that's kind of bit Duke in recent years is they've had to rely on so many young guys that you don't have those guys that have been in the program for a few years and have played a lot of minutes. And I think that's hurt them. And North Carolina last year is a great example. You lose some very talented pieces dating back to that championship year in 2017. But who do you have left? I mean, you've got guys like Luke May. You've got a guy like Cameron Johnson, who's played a lot of basketball, even though some of it was at Pitt. Kenny Williams has played a lot of minutes. And so you've got the veterans. Then you can add in Kobe White. You can add in Nasir Little. And you've got a very sound, complete lineup. But I think if you look at what happened in North Carolina, they lost the top five scorers from last year's team. You're projecting forward. They're going to lose Keeling. They're going to lose Pierce. They're going to lose likely Cole Anthony and Brandon Robinson, who may be able to start. So you're talking about four potential starters that you're losing immediately, and two of the guys were grad transfers that come in. So, yes, they are stopgap, but I think that speaks to why Roy kind of tipped his hand and saying, look, I'd rather have the freshman in than having to rely on the grad transfer route, because you want to make sure guys are able to kind of build up. Garrison Brooks is a great example. I know we'll talk about him in a little bit, but he's a guy you played good minutes first year, had a very good year last year, and they're really going to count on him this year and next year to really kind of be the presence inside that they need, especially on the defensive end of the floor.
And, I think we started off this talking about all the offers in the class of 2020. And what Greg said articulates pretty much why that's happening. They wanted a big class in 2019, and they got it. It just wasn't exactly what they expected. So in 2020, I think they are taking precaution to make sure that they do have two or three guys who are going to stay around for more than 1 year. They want to, we all know the Royisms, which is basically that he wants experienced talent, and you can't get experienced talent if your talent leaves after 1 year. So he wants a mix. I think last year, in an ideal world, is kind of what he wanted. He had two seniors, a graduate transfer in his fifth year, and two really talented freshmen and a sophomore who played a good amount. So he had a good balance of all those things. So I think last year's roster probably is closer to what he envisions as, his type of championship team.
Good stuff there. Great points. We got plenty more to talk about on that line, but I'm going to talk a little bit about JohnnyT-shirt.com. Of course, folks have heard me talk about it in the past. They've heard Inside Carolina talk about it in the past, and there's a good reason. One, they're the sponsor of this podcast, and they do a lot of great things for us at Inside Carolina, but they also do a ton for Carolina fans across the board, whether it's on Franklin Street or online. You can get their customer service that's second to none as far as Carolina gear. It's all Carolina all the time. Anything you need, whether it's a shirt, some pants, some sweats, hats, keychains, anything you can imagine, JohnnyT-shirt.com's got it. And Johnny T-shirt on Franklin Street's got it. It's a great place to stop when you're on campus, whether you're visiting in the summer or whether you're in town for a ball game. Of course, they've got all the football gear you'll need for the season coming up, and they've got plenty of basketball gear for the season we're talking about now. JohnnyT-shirt.com, Johnny T-shirt on Franklin Street, locally owned, alumni operated, great place to go. And if you're that Inside Carolina Premium subscriber, not only do you get Sherelle's weekly scoops and other great information that you can't find anywhere else, you get that 10% off your orders in-store and online, johnnytshirt.com, this Inside Carolina podcast sponsor. Let me stay where we are because we asked some questions on Twitter or saw some questions on Twitter, and somebody asked about the long game, and we sort of talked about it a little bit, but I wanted to get in it more, is how do you develop players in this era now? And Roy Williams likes to do it, but it seems like it's getting tougher. And Greg, I'll come to you first with it since we mentioned Garrison Brooks. He is a prime example, I think, of how Roy Williams is still able to accomplish that. And I think Garrison Brooks becomes a major factor in Roy Williams' team, even with Baycott coming in, even with the grad transfers that can play on the wings and help out. Garrison Brooks, his development, his progression, and where he's come and where he can go is going to be huge for this season.
Yeah, and I think it really kind of factors into what we've been talking about in terms of you're bringing in 4 to 5 freshmen, you know, per class if you can, as close to that as possible. Because within that, you're going to have guys like Cole Anthony, who's going to hit the ground running and is going to be good from game one. But you're also going to have, you know, a guy like Garrison Brooks. You're also going to have a guy like, you know, Marcus Page. You know, those are a little bit different prospects, but we can use that as an example. You know, Marcus was thrust into the point guard role early, and he really, really struggled, but he showed promise his first year and then kind of exploded, you know, his sophomore year. So he really only needed 1 year to kind of get comfortable. Garrison is a guy that he probably needed a year and a half. I would say, you know, from my perspective, it seemed to be really kind of January or February when he just really became a consistent presence for them defensively. And I think that helped everything offensively for him as well. So you're going to have those types of players. And so when you talk about kind of this age of ball, I think that's a valid question. And that may be why Roy won't necessarily the grad transfers, you know, having to count on those guys year in and year out, because there is a process involved there. I mean, Cam Johnson, you know, granted, I know a lot of Cam's issues were injuries, but just think about how much he grew from last year to this year. You know, nobody would have projected Cam to be a lottery pick, you know, midway through last year, right? I mean, that nobody would have. But yet he was able to get a year under his belt. He was able to get healthy, work with Jonas quite a bit, and improved his game, and he kind of exploded. And then I think you also have to talk about a guy like, you know, Kobe White. Kobe came in, and Roy talked about how there's going to be some learning curve there. But what does Roy do? Does Roy scale back the offense? Does he scale back how he kind of builds his teams to let the freshmen catch up? No. And that's one of the critiques with Nasir Little, right, is that, you know, he's not kind of building things around Nasir. He's making Nasir kind of step into the, you know, the team at full speed. And for some players, they can pick it up. For some players, there's a little bit of a challenge there. And then when you add in the fact that, you know, Nasir was kind of a unique talent, I think there was some difficulty kind of figuring out what he was supposed to be and how he could help the team best while showing, you know, showcasing his talents. But Kobe, he showed splashes early, but there was a lot of games where he had way too many turnovers, a lot of games where he just took some bad shots. But as he got into ACC play, he got comfortable. And so depending on the player, you know, their learning curve and their growth trajectory is going to be a lot shorter, you know, for a guy like Kobe, or for Garrison, it may be 18 months. And so that's really the challenge. And I really think the fact that, you know, some of these guys, it takes more than a year, is why Roy wants to make sure he can get some of these kids to come in. I mean, and Kenny Williams, and when you talk about injuries, I think Kenny's a great example. They knew coming in, they thought he could be a very good shooter for him. How many threes did he have his freshman year? He had one, right? And then he gets injured his second year. So entering his junior year, we're like, well, you know, we've seen a little bit. We think he can do this. We think he can be this kind of player. We haven't really seen it. But because he was within the program and he was able to kind of build and get healthy and all this kind of things, he became a very key piece for this team the last 2 years. So I think that's kind of the key component, is having the ability to grow them and without kind of sacrificing for the team. Because as Roy's always said, he coaches for the program, not really for any specific year in terms of installation of his offense and defense.
Sure, that's a great point Greg makes there at the end, and I want your take on it, because a lot of people ask in some of those Twitter questions, message board questions, is will Roy Williams adjust his offense given the personnel that'll be on the floor this year? And I don't see it happening that much. I mean, they have plenty of wings. They're going to have Cole Anthony, who a lot of people have called, one of the best pure point guards they've had in a long time. But in general, what does Roy Williams adjust this coming season, if anything?
You know, with specificity, I couldn't exactly tell you, but I do think, here's an example. Just talking to people, around the program or whatever, Cole Anthony's greatest skill, or one of the things he's really, really good at, is playing in pick and roll situations. And I know pick and roll now is kind of a buzz term that people use when they want to sound smart about playing basketball, but it is fundamentally one of the basic plays in all of basketball now at pretty much every level. And, Cole's really good in making decisions off of it, whether it's to, go over, go under, shoot, whatever, all the permutations of what he's supposed to do off pick and roll, he's really good at. That's one thing that everybody we talked to, whether it was his dad or NBA people or other college coaches, high school coaches, AU coaches, they all talked about how great he was at that. So I think you'll see Roy Williams, maybe put him in a couple of situations, put him in pick and roll situations more in a game within the constructs of North Carolina's offense, if that makes any sense. So again, not to use the word tweak again, but it would be more of a tweak than it would be a change. And I think he's done that consistently over the years. He's kind of molded what he does well into what he has on the team currently. That's going back to a couple of years ago when they had to play small last year, when they played small some more. It was, talking to Dewey and Adrian and people who know much more about the intricacies of basketball than, you or I. They talked about again and again how things were different, but they were still very similar. And it was just, a tweak here, a player in a different spot there, but it was still the overall same offense. So I think that's what you'll see is Roy Williams, just tweak his offense a little bit for Cole Anthony in particular. The rest of it, I think it'll be just traditional Roy Williams basketball, what we've come to expect and know.
Yeah, I think kind of the key component here is when you talk about Roy Williams' offense, the way it's been described to me multiple times by various people around the program, either who have worked with Roy or have played for Roy, is that it's a philosophy. And that he has, it's a motion deal, it's freelance, it's based on utilizing the players that are playing their talents. And so if you have a guy like Cole Anthony, and some of the insight that we've received with some of the pickup games this summer, as Terrell says, one of his strengths clearly is pick and roll. I didn't know that pick and roll was like a fancy term now, Terrell, because that's old school. I mean, that's you're drawing screens in the dirt when we're kids, I guess it's kind of come back.
Yeah, it's just what people say now when they want to sound.
That's Curtis Blow, man.
It's like pick and roll situations. I know basketball. Anyway, go ahead.
I like the pick and roll. I like the give and go. Go, Greg.
But apparently, Cole and Armando Bacot, for example, had several pick and roll situations early against the older guys. And they look pretty good doing it. And of course the older guys are like, all right, we see what they're doing now. And they kind of shut it down. And so that's kind of what Roy wants to do. He wants to say, all right, well, who's going to be best, using, these different style of, whatever tweaks we use with the secondary break, whatever specific plays that we call. I mean, how do guys like to come off screens, right? I mean, how do guys like to use, screens at the top of the key? Do they like, the high-low, do they operate better? Do we have good enough passers down in the post that we can use that high-low effectively? And that's all going to be dependent upon what type of players that Roy has on hand. And I think in hearing from people thus far who have watched some of the pickup games, I think there's a lot to be ironed out. Like, I think all of us know that Cole Anthony is going to be the engine that makes this thing work. But Leaky Black's still not back to full health. you know, we know Jeremiah Francis is going to be out for a little while. Anthony Harris is still sidelined. Sterling Manley still sidelined. Justin Pierce and Christian Keeling are just trying to kind of get accustomed to what UNC is about. You know, Armando, of course, is a true freshman trying to feel his way around. So we're not going to see what the talents of this team are beyond maybe a guy like Garrison Brooks, beyond maybe, you know, Cole Anthony, even Brandon Robinson. We kind of know what he can do. But I think beyond that, there's a lot of question marks. And until Roy's able to get them into practice, in preseason practice, we see how they perform against Notre Dame in some of those early games. I think it's too early, really, to kind of project what works best. I mean, we've heard stats show that Pierce can shoot some threes. Well, if you've got a guy that's maybe playing the four who can knock down some threes, well, that's going to change things for you, as opposed to maybe having Armando and Garrison down on the post. And so a lot of those different things will play into how Roy changes things. But as Sherrell says, your core concepts are going to be the same. It's just a matter of, you know, what plays you insert in. How do you switch up things with your breaks? Those types of things.
Plenty more questions for you guys. I got a ton more questions to ask, but let's take a short break. We'll be right back on the Inside Carolina podcast, sponsored by JohnnyT-Shirt.com.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too, with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic and conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Sherrell, I read the pickup game report, and I'll be honest, the thing that stuck to me the most is not about Cole Anthony. It's not about guys not being healthy. It's about Garrison Brooks again. And the comment that he's training to be a power forward rather than a center. You know, I don't know if that's a huge deal, but the question posed in the pickup game report is, I wonder if he'll get some of those Luke May type shots. And Luke May was a huge part of the pick and roll or the pick and pop that Carolina would run. I mean, is Garrison Brooks really a guy that can assume some of that role? I think we all think it'll be Pierce taking a lot of those, but is Garrison Brooks getting that for him, or is he working on that because that's something maybe Roy Williams and the staff said, look, we need to get this ironed out because we need you in that role?
Well, you know, he doesn't have to be a competent shooter out to the three-point line to be able to do some of the pick-and-pop stuff. I know, you know, you talk to folks who live by analytics, and they'll tell you that a long two is the, you know, Rick Pitino famously said it, that a long two is the worst shot in basketball. But when Bryce Johnson was at North Carolina, I mean, he took maybe three or four threes his senior season. Everything he did came at the rim and in kind of that mid-range. And, you know, when Garrison Brooks came to North Carolina, he said, Roy Williams told me I'm a power forward and I'm going to be competing with Luke May for the starting power forwards position. Now, what happened is that because some of the other bigs weren't as advanced as, they wanted them to be when they came in as freshmen, Brooks was, you know, kind of head and shoulders above the other two. And so he got the nod as a starter at the beginning of that season when Cam Johnson was hurt. So I think you'll see Brooks do some of that stuff. I think he can shoot, you know, out to 13 or 14 feet, kind of that mid range. He's shown, I think he's capable of doing that. And if it's something he's worked on so far in the offseason and will continue to work on until fall practice starts, and I don't see any reason why he can't be paired with Armando Bacot, doing some high low stuff and, you know, being a functional replacement for Luke May. Again, North Carolina doesn't have to have that in their offense. They don't have to have a four who can shoot threes. They've been pretty good for several years without one who can do that. It's great that Luke May was able to do that, but we talk about fitting the philosophy and the offensive construct around kind of your talent, and Roy Williams has done that with bigs who aren't three-point shooters when they're in North Carolina.
Yeah, and I think the other thing too, Tom, is in the previous pickup game, and kind of what we were told is that Brooks was not taking those shots and that he was, in fact, really trying to create off the block with some unique offensive moves that we really haven't seen out of him in recent years. So I think it's really just a matter of him kind of trying to expand his game. But I will say, kind of to Sherrill's point, it's not like North Carolina needs Garrison to become some outside shooter. I mean, sorry, but if you're relying on Garrison Brooks to knock down 4 to 5 18-footers for you to win games, good luck. Not dissing Garrison at all, but that's not his game. That's fine. And so Roy's not going to put him in that position. However, we know Garrison is a pretty good passer. And so when you start saying, okay, well, how is North Carolina so effective against the zone? Well, where are the weak spots of the zone? The free throw line, right? North Carolina is very successful with the high-low. What we saw in the first two rounds of the NCAA tournament, Luke May and Nasir Little, when they were able to get the ball there at the free throw line, they just completely blew the zones up. So if Garrison can turn around and we know he can pass, if he can make some good passes, maybe that'll free him up to have that little 15-footer for occasion, and if he can knock that down, that stresses the defense even more. And then, of course, you got the short corner. So if he can knock down that little jumper too, all of a sudden, teams are going to have to change how they try to guard North Carolina. And so I think more than anything, that's where he's going to be opportunistic. Knock down some shots from the elbow. But I think if North Carolina is going to have to ask him to take shots further out, I don't think that's going to be effective. And that's why I don't think Roy's going to do that. He's not going to put the red light on necessarily, but that's not going to be the ideal shot.
Terrell, let's check out some more of these Twitter questions. And, like I've said earlier, if you want all the recruiting information, you need to get on the premium message board and check out all that. I mean, there's too much to even account for and a lot going on. So you need to check those out on Sherrill's Weekly Scoop. But Sherrill, let me ask you a question that somebody mentioned on Twitter. And it's interesting to me because it was basically who's going to be Carolina's second leading scorer. And we're so far out from the season, a lot of guys got to get healthy, but it's fun to do and it's the summer. So I would assume that the assumption that person makes is that Cole Anthony's the leading scorer. I'm not really sure that's the case, but your thoughts, and then Greg, I want yours as well.
I think, so if you'd asked me this a month ago, I probably would have said Christian Keeling, and nothing has changed with Keeling. I still think he'll be North Carolina's starter at the two. I think he's talented. I think he's a good shooter, and he can really help them. But the more I think about the connection that Cole Anthony and Armando Bacot have, coupled with Sterling Manley being injured and, Brandon Huffman still needing to do some improving, Armando Bacot's going to get a lot of touches in the post. And you talk about North Carolina, potentially being a really good passing team. I think Brandon Robinson is a good passer. We know Leaky Black is a good passer. We think Cole Anthony will likely be a good passer. Justin Pierce has shown in college that he's a pretty solid passer. And Keeling has shown some of that ability as well. Bacot's going to have a lot of shots, at the rim uncontested. So, I mean, he could get fairly easily, 8 to 10 points just on, dunks that come wide open or tip-ins, that kind of thing. And then if he just makes one or two moves in the post per game or gets to the free throw line, you're already talking about 12 to 13 points. So I think it'll be Bacot for that reason, just because seems like he's going to have a lot of opportunity.
Greg, you think Cole Anthony is the leader of this team from day one on the score in the score sheet? And do you agree with Sherelle that they could be led by two freshmen? I think that would be interesting. And I'd wonder, is that a first for Roy Williams' coach team? Heck, maybe even a Carolina team, period.
Yeah, I think Anthony is going to have to be the leading scorer, at least early, until everybody kind of gets settled in. But I think Garrison Brooks is going to have a big year for this team. There's a lot of pieces that kind of have to work into the fold, and I understand that. And this team will look a lot different once we get to February. But Garrison Brooks is going to have to be a double-double machine. He's going to have to be a guy that gets you 14 and 10 pretty much every night. And maybe Armando gets to a point later in the season where he can be that consistent presence. I do think, just knowing how kind of freshmen are, I would assume that he'll have some really good games and he'll put up some numbers. You'll be like, wow, if he could do that every night, this kid could be one and done. And then he'll go quiet for a couple games. And we saw that some early last year with both Kobe and Nasir, and really Nasir for most of the year. Keeling, I think it's going to be interesting to see how he kind of works in, because he is a pretty slim guy, pretty small. And so if he gets hot, maybe he's the guy that can score some for you. But it'll be interesting. I think Brandon Robinson is going to be a key piece. And I know he's not going to be a guy that people look at and say, wow, he's averaging 12 a game. I don't know that he can do that unless he's knocking down some threes. But also think Leaky Black's the guy that has to be productive. I think he has to be that utility man, maybe more so this year than what North Carolina has needed in years past. I mean, we've seen guys like Theo Pinson, like in the 17 year, he did a little bit of everything. And I think Leaky's going to have to do that. And so maybe Leaky's a guy that can average 10 a game. And so Baycott for sure could be in the mix, but I think Garrison is number two, and I would say Leaky's got to be maybe 2A.
Somebody fact check me on Carolina freshman leading the score, and I'd be interested to see it. But Sherelle, Greg mentions Leaky Black, and of course he's missed some time this summer. How important is he to this team's success this year? Because I think the Pinson reference fits, but I think that he is a guy that can be a difference maker. But I'm not sure if he's going to be. You know what I mean? I don't know if he's going to jump into that role this season. Your thoughts on him overall?
First, to answer your question, I think it would have to be Felton and McCants, unless Jawad was in there somehow, a little higher scoring than Felton in 2000.
Maybe the 05-06 team?
Yeah, maybe.
I think Noel was the number two scorer on that team.
Okay.
I would lean towards Felton McCants. Someone can go look this up, but that's where my mind immediately went to, just because I wasn't sure how much Jawad averaged I guess that would have been his junior year. Anyway, to answer your question, Leaky Black, I said in our first postseason podcast that I thought he might be as important as anyone on the team. Now, grain of salt, he won't be as important as Cole Anthony. And let's make that clear. Like, I think people just, again, have to be prepared that this is Cole Anthony's team. I know that, Carolina has a way it likes to do things, and, the upperclassmen kind of bring you along and everything. But this, without a doubt, is going to have Cole Anthony's imprint all over it. He's going to have the ball in his hand all the time. He's going to have an insane usage rate. He's going to be able to shoot, with the green light. He's going to control the team. All that said, I think Leaky is very important for the reason that Greg said, is that he can cover you pretty much, one through three. So if Anthony Harris isn't quite back to full health in, say, November, I don't think that'll be the case, but say he's not, Leaky can help, at the two. He'll probably also be the primary backup point guard. If there's an injury at the three, he can play the three, or he can be in a lineup where, a small lineup, he can do some of the distributing if they want to shift down. So he can really do a little bit of everything, and, he just has to get healthy. I think that's the main thing for him. I think the talent is there. Roy Williams sees it. I think a lot of people saw it last year. He was kind of poised to gain a lot more minutes right when he got injured. So it was terrible timing, because he was really about to be integrated more fully into the lineup. But for those reasons, and considering North Carolina just has an unknown behind Cole Anthony in the backcourt, I think Leaky is vitally important. And you know, to that degree, his health is as well.
For the record, I'm looking at the stats from Felton and McCants freshman year. McCants led the team 17 points. Jawad Williams second, at least what I'm looking at. If they're right,
I thought he might sneak in there, so I was wrong.
And then I hadn't gotten to the others, but Greg, when I'm listening to you guys talk, and I'm reading the message boards, I get a very different vibe on how good maybe this team can be. And we can always talk about they're going to be very different in February or whatever. But I'd be lying if I said it did not concern me a little bit with so many unknowns going into a season. I mean, has there been, aside from maybe after everybody left after the 05 championship or people going pro, aside from those years, have you experienced, or do you think it's overstating it, that there's probably as many unknowns going into this Carolina basketball season as there has been in a while?
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, even if you go back to the 2009-2010 team, you know, after the title in 2009 and the mass exodus of players, you still had guys like Marcus Guignard and Deion Thompson. I mean, key pieces of that title team. And now we're talking about, I mean, you've got your top five scorers are gone. You do have Garrison Brooks back. But he was really just kind of a defensive presence for him down low. He wasn't an offensive weapon by any stretch. And then you got, you know, Brandon Robinson, who came in spot minutes. And so that's about it. And you know, Sherrell said Leakey was kind of working his way up to having a bigger role, and then he gets hurt. So that's kind of an unrealized potential there for Leakey. And then when you add in some grad transfers, you got the freshman. You're having to count on Cole Anthony to do a lot. I mean, we're talking about, and I think Sherrell's exactly right. I mean, usage rate's going to be through the roof. He's going to have to make things happen for this team, especially early. But we're talking about a true freshman. And, you know, last year, as great as Kobe was, and he was great, I really think he benefited from having Luke May, Cam Johnson, and Kenny Williams, because they gave him room to fail. He had some bad games. He took some bad shots, had a lot of turnovers in some games. But they were able to kind of carry the day until he kind of got, you know, his feet under him more consistently. And consistency was his big thing. You know, Cole doesn't have that safety net. And that's a lot of pressure on him. So I do. I think there's a lot of question marks. And this is kind of the result of Roy Williams being as successful as he's been. Is, you know, both in recruiting and on the court, right? Recruiting-wise, he takes some guys and you're like, man, Luke May and Kenny Williams are the only two guys he has in that recruiting class. This is going to go south quickly. And what happens? Right? I mean, they've a number one seed, what, 3 years in a row? And I think kind of the same with some of these teams. You know, we saw with 09, 2010, which Roy would say injuries are the main reason that season was as bad as it was. But that was really about it. You know, even 12, 13 was a decent year, even though it was somewhat of a step back. But we've seen Roy do this for so long. They were like, you know what? Yeah, it looks bad. Or it doesn't look good. We can at least say that. But Roy being Roy, as he builds this team over the course of the season, by February, they're going to be rolling. And so I think we have faith that that will happen. But a lot of things have to come into play. A lot of things have to work out. You know, Christian Keeling, he's got to be a good scorer. I mean, that's going to have to happen for him to – you'll be able to contribute and really help this team. Cole's got to be Cole. He's got to be the player we've built him up to be. Garrison has to take that next step. Leakey has to be this player we've talked about. So a lot of things have to happen that we really haven't seen yet. And so, yeah, I think there's reason for legitimate concern. And if Roy Williams wasn't the head coach, I don't think our outlook on this season would be near what it is.
That's kind of where I'm at, Greg, is that I do this every offseason, and you start asking yourself, okay, the fewer number of questions that you have to ask about whether or not North Carolina is going to be good means that they'll probably be good. The more questions you have to ask, you start to wonder. And last season, we were having this exact same conversation. The questions were, you know, can Samith Woods be a starting point guard? Can Kobe White come in as a freshman and start at point guard? Kenny Williams has never had the scoring load that he might have to carry this year. Can he do it? Luke May looked like he got a little tired towards the end of last season. Will he be able to rebound this year? Cam Johnson is coming off of a major surgery. Is he going to be healthy? Can he be a guy who takes his games to the next level? Nasir Little is coming in with all the accolades and everything. Can he be a player who really makes an impact for North Carolina? And they ended up, a number one seed, won 28 games, I believe. So I just think, we have to be careful for the very reason you said, is that Williams is the coach and he's shown himself to be very good at what he's doing. And I don't mean to dismiss the questions, but I don't mean to be pie in the sky guy like I always am, but I've said this probably 17 times on this podcast over the years. The fact that we're talking about missing Luke May and Kenny Williams is reason enough to believe that Carolina will be okay, because those are players who weren't, thought of as highly as a lot of other players, and they got better their entire time at Carolina. And I think it's safe to assume that Brandon Robinson and Leahy Black and Sterling Manley and Garrison Brooks and Andrew Playtech will, kind of follow in the same tradition as all the other players before them and improve. And then you integrate the newcomers in. And I think, North Carolina will be a solid team. Now, I'm not saying they're going to be a number one seed again, but I do think they'll be competitive near the top of the ACC again.
It's fascinating. We always do this podcast. There's always something that sticks out from this podcast we do every summer. A couple summers ago, it was Greg Barnes talking about, and I think it was you, Greg, said there'll never be another day that Luke May doesn't start a basketball game at Carolina because he's going to start forever. And that may have been even 3 years ago. And for me and for this one, it's the comment about Kobe had room to fail last year because of who he had on the team, and Cole Anthony may not have that same room to fail this year. It's fascinating. It'll be fascinating to see how it plays out.
Well, I want to talk to Greg about that and push back just a little bit. So, Greg, you mean overall, as a team, Kobe had a little more room to fail. Is that what you're saying? Because he presumably had more talented, experienced players around him?
Yeah, and the fact that there were several games, especially on the road early, like the NC State game for sure at PNC. But there were games where Luke and Kenny and Cam just took over, and they were the workload. And I thought it was pretty funny early in the year. Kenny even talked about it. Yeah, we expect as the seniors on this team to carry the day, and the freshmen will come along. But that's kind of what I meant, is that if you don't have those three guys, and it's Kobe, Nasir, here's the ball, go win his ball games, I think that puts you in a very difficult spot. It can hurt confidence if it doesn't go well. But because those guys weren't forced to be the stars from day one, they were able to kind of slowly come along and really build as the season progressed.
Gotcha. Understood. I thought you meant positionally as opposed to the entire team.
No.
Gotcha.
Well, he didn't have was it the PNC Raleigh game that Kenny, Luke, and Cam Johnson all had double-doubles?
Correct.
And Carolina and Kobe played bad, and they were able to win it. That's a lot of pressure for a freshman. I mean, Cole Anthony's used to it. Obviously, we'll see if it translates. There's still a ways to go before we get there. Even though November 6th, I believe it is, against Notre Dame, not that far away. Guys, before I wrap this podcast, I wanted to get y'all's take on the NBA draft that just happened. And I know folks are like, who cares? It's over with. But it's interesting because I was surprised a guy like Nasir Little slipped as far as he did. Not because I thought he's going to be a superstar in the league, but I thought he would go higher. And so I want to talk about that a little bit, and we can talk about Cam and Kobe as well. But Sherelle, your thoughts on that? A lot of people say when you slip, you wind up with a better team, and he certainly did. It's not always the case the way the draft works with all the crazy trades and picks and all that stuff. But your thoughts on how that shook out for Nasir Little?
Yeah, first of all, I hated it for the family. And, this is with any family, but particularly this one since we've covered them so close. But when they're in, the green room and the television's on them and, you get to pick 10 and it's like, okay, well, maybe soon. And then you get to 15 and then you get to 20 and then you get to 22. And it's like, well, is this ever going to happen? And you could kind of see it on him and his family's face. So that was my first thought, was more of an emotional human kind of empathetic thought, like, man, that must be tough. Yeah, this is one of the best days of your life. Yeah, you're going to still make a good amount of money, but you know, it probably was a bit humbling, and I'm sure it wasn't quite the night he expected. So I hated to see that for him and his family. I was surprised from a basketball standpoint, just because, you know, we've been able to source some of these things a little bit and talk to people who would know, and nobody, and I think that's why he was invited to the green room, nobody expected him to fall that far. Talking to a few people just around, you know, Carolina basketball, around the NBA, we had heard, you know, somewhere late lottery kind of into the teens. So let's just call it like 10 through 17 or something like that. That's pretty much the consensus of what everyone said. Like I said, that's why he was invited to the green room. So when it went past 17, I was just kind of in shock. Like, how could this happen? What caused it? But I think in the end, it ended up being one of those blessing in disguise type situations, because he gets to play with one of the best backcourts in the NBA. He's with a pretty solid franchise. They have a couple of guys who are there who are getting a little bit older, who maybe are not as spry as they once were, and maybe he can come in and start for them and be on a good team and then work his way and make some of that money back on the second contract. So that, like I said, my first reaction was one of just kind of empathy for them having to go through that on national TV. And the second was that maybe it wasn't such a bad thing for him to end up in Portland.
Speaking of that, Bol Bol sitting there for 4 or 5 hours. I mean, I thought that was ridiculous that they invite all those guys and then stick cameras in their faces the whole time. But that's another story. Greg, your thoughts on Nasir and then on Kobe and Cam. Bigger surprise for you, Cam Johnson going that high or Nasir Little slipping as far as he did?
Well, I'll echo what Sherelle said with Nasir slipping as far as he did and being in the green room and having to deal with that. You know, I'm sure that there's a little bit of embarrassment there, which there shouldn't be. I mean, the kid, you know, has made an incredible life for himself just with that one night. But you do hate to see your kids kind of sit through that, because they are still kids. I mean, was he 19? And so I know that was tough, and I did not like to see that. But I think when you talk about Kobe and Cam, that's what sticks out to me more than anything, because if you'd ask me at the end of the year, who are the two best players on North Carolina's team? I don't think there's any question that it was Kobe and Cam. So when you start talking about, you know, Nasir as a pro prospect, well, it's based on potential. Now, I don't know that we saw enough last year to say, you know what, this guy, surefire lottery pick. We saw a guy that is a freakish athlete, a guy that has potential to be a very good player. You know, had to improve his handle, he's got to improve his shot, a couple things like that. But then his ceiling's through the roof. But yet, you look at Kobe, we know what kind of player Kobe is, right? He's a scorer, he can push tempo, he's aggressive. What's Cam Johnson? He is an elite shooter. He's tall, right? He's the kind of guy, like Roy Williams said, Golden State would love to have a guy like that. If they had him in the finals, you know, maybe we're talking about a different NBA champion. And so I think we all knew Kobe was going to be, you know, top 10 for sure. I was a little surprised when Cam was projected kind of late first round, the day or two before the draft. I mean, I think some mocks had him like at 30, 29, 30, which seemed pretty low. But for him to go as high as he did, I think it's incredible. It's a testament to him, testament to his family. I think that's just a tremendous story. And as Roy said last week, you know, the negative to how the first round went is that Nasir did go 25th. And so that welcomes back the comments of what Roy can't develop one and done talent. That's why he's not getting these one and done guys. What Roy can push back and say, look, Cam Johnson was like 220th coming out of high school. And nobody thought this kid was going to be a lottery pick. But yet, here's Cam Johnson as a lottery pick. And then Kobe White, same way. Nobody's projecting Kobe to be a lottery pick before his freshman season. And so that dichotomy I find very fascinating. And it kind of goes back to how the message boards were last year, right? It's like you had two distinct groups. You had the group that said, Roy cannot develop this type of talent. He's blowing his chances with future one-and-done kids. by not getting Nasir to play up to his ability. And then you had another group saying, maybe Nasir is just not there yet. Maybe Roy's given him opportunities, but he's not quite the player that we all expect him to be. And of course, the answer is somewhere in between. You know, it's always kind of shades of gray. But that's going to be a debate that continues, especially with Nasir going as low as he did, that Roy's going to have to keep answering. And he will keep using Cam and Kobe as examples for why that narrative is wrong.
I was just annoyed, and I know we're running out of time. I was just annoyed by the whole Cam Johnson age thing. It really gets on my nerves. Like, you would think he's geriatric, and you know he can't move and he can't run. The dude is 24. I mean, it's not like he's 38. He's 24. Yeah, he's had a couple surgeries, but he's the healthiest he's been. If you talk to anybody, Roy Williams has said it, Cam has said it, his father said it. He's the healthiest he's probably been since ninth grade. And you saw what he did when he was healthy. He had one of the better shooting seasons in North Carolina history. So I just think all of the, you know, the age concerns are, I think it's just so stupid, to be honest. It makes no sense.
And I think it was Brian Ives who said, he's the researchers, I believe it was him, but said that Cam is the oldest lottery pick since Tyler Hansbrough 10 years ago.
So that's interesting. It's a lot of money to own potential.
And if Brian didn't say that, I apologize, but I'm pretty sure he's the one that tweeted that out.
Sherelle, last question. And, you know, with these podcasts, they can last as long as we want, as long as people are still listening. But
if you're still listening, thank you.
If you're still here, I got a good question. Is one reason you think Nasir slipped, and I don't want to knock on this too much because I do think he's in a great position out in Portland, but and as opposed to Kobe and Cam. Okay, 6'5 point guards, as fast as Kobe and as good as Kobe, aren't a dime a dozen. 6'9 shooters like Cam Johnson aren't a dime a dozen. But aren't 6'6, 6'7 wings in the league, aren't they pretty common? And that's why maybe, or that has something to do with why maybe a talent like Nasir slipped? I mean, is there any explanation that fits? Does that one?
Maybe. I mean, you know, he is, I think he measured at 6'6 at the combine, but he had a wingspan of 7'2, maybe it might've been 7'3. It was something really long. And so that makes up for, you know, some, him being 6'6. If you 6'6 with a 7'2 wingspan, then, you know, guarding a 6'8 player really isn't a big deal. So I'm not sure if that one is it. Honestly, we've tried to find out, and I don't know. I guess just the season in North Carolina scared a few people off. It's surprising because all the information we were getting back was that he had done really well in workouts, that he shot well, that, you know, he showed teams, you know, what they wanted to see, that he interviewed well. So it was just surprising. I don't know if there's one particular answer. It could just be, you know, if you do that draft 100 times, maybe he only falls to 25th five or six times. And this was one of those five or six times. But I do think he's in a good situation. I just hated it for him and his family, the way it kind of played out.
Indeed. I tweeted out he's going to have an Aaron Rodgers-sized chip on his shoulder. Some people didn't agree with that. Some people did. Good thing is that we'll find out. Sherelle and Greg, it's always been fun to talk basketball in the middle of June or late June. We got one more of these off-season podcasts, and then it'll be here before you know it. But as always, JohnnyT-Shirt.com is our sponsor, and Greg and Sherelle are the guys that drive this ship. Or I drive it. You guys make it. You make it such a big, glorious ship that is Inside Carolina Podcast. Thanks, guys.
Yeah, appreciate it, Tommy.
Thanks, Tommy.
Thanks for listening to another podcast from InsideCarolina.com. Brought to you by JohnnyT-Shirt.com. Where to go for your next Tar Heel gear purchase.